Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've been stuck in this country debating science and religion. Can we settle it? Get beyond it? Should we? Must we? We're going to see right now. We've got Deepak Chopra in the studio and big man of science, physicist Leonard Mlodinow, for the War of Worldviews, this hour on Point Science versus Spirituality. Deepak Chopra and Leonard Mlodinow, you can join the conversation. Does this war rage in your head, your home, community, between science and the soul? Does it have to? Where do you come down? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is the world-famous spiritual guide and writer Deepak Chopra, a huge bestseller in book after book, tape after tape, named one of the top 100 heroes and icons of the century by Time magazine. He's author of more than 60 books on spirituality and mind-body medicine. He's co-authored the new book, War of the Worldviews, Science versus Spirituality. Deepak Chopra, great to have you. Welcome back
Thank
to
you,
On
Tom.
Point. Thank you for being here. Also with us in the studio is the other side of the coin, theoretical physicist Leonard Mlodinow, co-author with Stephen Hawking of two volumes, The Grand Design and A Briefer History of Time, author of the number one New York Times bestseller, A Drunkard's Walk on Randomness in Our Lives, co-author with Deepak Chopra of War of the Worldviews. Leonard Mlodinow, welcome back to you as well. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Wow, amazing to have the two of you in the studio at once on God and Man, Spirit and Science. We saw how this began, this tome on the book right here, last year during an ABC Nightline debate over God's future at the California Institute of Technology. Anchor Dan Harris pulled physicist Leonard Mlodinow out of the crowd to pose a question to panelist Deepak Chopra.
What's your question?
Would you like to have a short course in quantum mechanics sometime so that we can straighten out your slightly misuse of quantum notation?
Thank you, Leonard.
I would be honored, sir, and I accept your offer with great gratitude. And I would like to be educated so I can be clearer in my dialogue.
And there you have it, the kind of smart alecky man of science and the gracious man of spirit meeting there around key questions in science. But the first one that I want to put to the two of you first is, can we not get over this? I don't remember this debate when I was growing up. There was a lot of science, there was plenty of religion, and America was not locked in this debate over one or the other for a long, long time. Seems to me this country had it both ways. Why do you think we're in this sort of headlock about it in the last couple of decades here, Leonard?
Well, why I don't know, but I know how, and that is that the politicians have gotten onto this issue and used it to campaign on. And so instead of talking about the real issues, the unemployment and the economy and the health care and all the problems that we have in the country, they choose to talk about the Bible and, I think, distract people.
Has it been a bad debate? Has it been a flawed debate, Deepak Chopra, that you've seen?
It's at a very primitive level. Because when religion talks about God or the divine or even spirituality, it's resorting to basically cultural mythology. In my view, the Bible is a cultural mythology, as all religions are. We have an evolving spirituality. An evolving spirituality, which is more about self-awareness than anything else, the nature of our consciousness. We still have the same questions. You know, why are we here? Do we have a soul? Is there meaning or purpose in life? What's the meaning of death? Does God exist? And if God exists, does he or she or it care about us? Those questions remain because they are eternal questions. But the dialogue needs to be elevated, and politicians, as Leonard says, are using a very base level of conversation to perpetuate this conflict.
We'll get to the elevation, but here we are starting at a very interesting point where you're the man representing God at the table today, mm-hmm. representing spirit, but do you disdain religion? Is that your starting point?
I think traditional religion does not conform to our understanding of what we know about the cosmos.
Who's our?
Huh?
Huh? Who is our in that sentence?
I think our is the scientific understanding of the cosmos today, which we cannot deny. We know, we can go back to 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds of creation. We understand evolution. We have a lot of problems in how we interpret these things, but I would be stupid to deny the scientific description of factual data.
Leonard, are you equally open and gracious toward the realm of spirit? Are you prepared to say, as a scientist, through and through, that there is, in fact, an important role for the spirit in your kind of calculations of what the cosmos is, what it means?
There's a very important role for the spirit in my life, and I think it plays an important role in all people's lives. I don't think that the spirit plays a role in our description of the physical world. I think that science does not tell you about the meaning of life. Science does not tell you why the universe follows laws. Science always starts from the laws that we observe and calculates the consequences. And in the grand design, for instance, with Stephen Hawking and I said that the physical laws are enough to explain the universe. We don't need to have the concept of God to explain where the universe came from. But we never said that there is no God, and science can never say that there is no God. And I think it's really a separate issue. There's an issue of faith in what may have created the universe and on all of us, and then there's the issue of how does the universe behave, and they needn't be at each other's throats. And it puzzles me why they often are. I mean, for instance, I go to the synagogue. Sometimes you might call it a cultural Jew. Mm-hmm. I believe in the values of a community, education, and many of the Jewish values of morality. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting in the synagogue. I read the Bible sometimes while the prayers are going on. And I was just reading it last week, and I was reading about how homosexuals should be put to death. How
this is Old Testament readings of the
course,
Bible.
Of course, Jewish. It's the Old Testament.
Yeah, the Torah.
Yeah, and it was also, I was reading the law that children who disrespect their parents should be put to death, which wouldn't leave too many in this way, at least going by my family. And what I don't understand, it suddenly struck me as I'm reading that, why are there people who obviously believe in the Bible but manage to ignore those statements of the Bible, and yet they hang on to the story of creation? And I just don't understand why some things are taken literally and other things are swept under the rug.
Let's take it right down to creation. So start with the beginning here. You've got two perspectives. We see where they may intersect, where they may even overlap. But this gets very, very essential. Creation itself. Creation itself. Deepak Chopra, does it start with science? Will we ultimately describe the sort of twirling of molecules or neutrinos or whatever it may be? Or does it start with, in your view, some manifestation of divine consciousness?
The shortest answer is the latter. It is a manifestation of divine consciousness. Having said that, I totally understand the view that Leonard espouses as the modern standard view of cosmology. Here's where the problem is. You know, science can take us back, as I said earlier, 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds after the so-called Big Bang.
Yes.
But when we get to that edge, the laws of physics break down. There are no laws. And therefore, this is not only the unknowable. It's not only the unknown. It's the unknowable. There are many unknowables in science, by the way. And they are not because of technical reasons. They are because the laws of physics preclude us from knowing them. And so as long as there's the mystery of the unknowable, as long as we cannot answer why those laws exist, as long as we cannot say why the universe conforms to those laws, as long as there is this great mystery of creation, that to me is a religious experience. It's a spiritual experience. Now, I have to say that unlike Richard Dawkins, who's a strident atheist,
an emotional
atheist.
Yes.
Leonard says in the book, and
yes,
I quote him,
yes,
he says, "Science cannot and will not conclude that God is an illusion." Richard Dawkins says, "The God delusion."
Yes, that's okay? The very title of his
the
book.
Very
but let me put it to Leonard. I mean, maybe science will not reach this conclusion, but then the definition of God itself can be a kind of ephemeral. Do you buy this, that on the other side of the current frontier of scientific understanding, that on the other side of, let's say, the Big Bang, stands God, stands divine consciousness? As a theoretical physicist yourself, do you agree with Deepak Chopra that it's not only unknown, that it is unknowable to science? Or is that just a frontier of ignorance? And one day we'll step beyond that as well.
No, I don't think I don't think it's knowable. I think it. I think there are unknowables. Science starts from physical laws. If I said, where do the laws of physics come from? And you were going to say, okay, some scientist says, I finally figured out where the laws of physics come from. That would be from another law, or at least from a principle. I mean, Einstein thought that, or hoped at least, that that the laws of physics would in the end be unique, that there would be only one set of possible laws based on logic. It doesn't seem like that's where we're going. But even if we did find that, then the idea that the laws of physics must be what they are would be based on some mathematical logic. And one could always ask, where does that come
from? So creation then, an act of God or a process that science will step by step untangle?
Well, that depends on what you mean by untangle or a process. I mean, science aims to understand where the universe came from. And as you know, Deepak, I thought, was slightly off when he said that the laws of physics break down at 10 to the minus 43 seconds. But there was a time where we don't know, we don't have the laws of quantum gravity to allow us to go back further. And also there's a time where the actual concept of time becomes far different than it is in our everyday lives.
Is so that God on the other side?
No,
or just the unknown?
See, that's for everyone to decide. But
I'm asking
it's not,
you.
It's not for me. It's not, no. And
it's not
physics
God
is not,
on the other side there, of it.
Not for me, no. Mm-hmm. But for physics, it doesn't address that question. So when I'm speaking personally, mm-hmm. I don't see that there was a God that started it all. But I do wonder sometimes what is responsible for these laws of physics.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about science and spirit with Deepak Chopra and theoretical physicist Leonard Mlodinow about how we see and understand the world at the most basic level. Their new book, co-authored, is War of the Worldviews, Science versus Spirituality. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Deepak Chopra, of course, huge bestseller time and again for his many, many books on spirit, spirituality, success in life through focus on those things, and much more. Leonard Mlodinow, author with Stephen Hawking of The Grand Design and A Briefer History of Time, his own best-selling The Drunkard's Walk on Randomness in Human Life. You reference Bernard Hecht, the astrophysicist, in the book. He quotes another astrophysicist, James Jeans, saying the universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine. He says that this is the essence of Deepak Chopra's view, that a great consciousness, which we share, is the basis of the universe and all reality. From Mlodinow's view, writes Hecht, it's unimaginable that consciousness could be anything more than brain chemistry at work, and certainly not something capable of creating a universe. It goes to this big human question: are we simply complex biological machines destined for oblivion at death, or are we immortal spiritual beings temporarily experiencing reality through physical bodies? 800-423-8255 is our number. Deepak Chopra, what about it?
Well, I'd like to quote two physicists, John Wheeler, who's associated with the words black hole, wormhole, quantum foam, it from bit. Here's the quote: every particle, every field of force, even the space-time continuum itself, derives its function, its meaning, its very existence entirely from apparatus-elicited answers to yes and no questions, binary choices. This is a participatory universe. Second quote, Heisenberg, one of the pioneers: what we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. I'll go a little further. What we observe is not nature itself, but nature as exposed to a human nervous system and the questioning that we have through a human nervous system.
But if it's a participatory universe, are you interpreting that as, you know, we're participating in dialogue with some divine consciousness, or are we participating in a scientific dialogue over a long, long time, just amongst ourselves, little, you know, frail mortal
humans.
What
I'm saying is this is a human nervous, this is a human universe. Everything that we know of the scientific understanding of the universe is because of our consciousness, okay? And if there's a universe outside our consciousness, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant, totally irrelevant. So science is a method, a very good map for understanding partial truth. To understand science, you need consciousness. Consciousness doesn't need science to understand consciousness. Consciousness needs self-awareness. So while he is looking at the observed and ignoring who's observing, it will remain a partial truth. If I want to know the whole truth, I have to not only understand what is being observed, I have to understand who's observing. And in the book, I quote mm-hmm. him as saying, science for now has not solved the problem of consciousness.
But it's getting closer and closer. I mean,
how?
Well, Leonard, I mean, there's been so much research into brain science, neuroscience, more and more detailed understanding of how decisions get made, the sort of binary participatory process. Deepak's shaking his considerable finger at me. Nevertheless, we've talked with, scientist after scientist who's laid out, including Dawkins and many more, who's laid out our march into the sort of brain processes and the science behind them.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues that just came up in the last 2 minutes. So let's start with the partial truth. The science is definitely a partial truth about the universe, and Deepak says it accusingly, but there's no reason that it should be accusing. Scientists don't claim to
science
have
science sees itself that way.
Right. Scientists don't pretend to explain the meaning of life or mm-hmm. God or where the laws of physics come from. We look at the observable universe, and I agree with Deepak that the universe we perceive is not just through the particular peculiarities of our senses, of our eyesight and our hearing, but also through our human brain and the peculiarities of its structure and the way it interprets things. And that's fine. And the point is, given that we are human, what is the universe we perceive and how can we make predictions about it? You know, what are we going to see and how does it work, given that we're the ones who are perceiving it? So the partial truth is fine. The question is, if there are truths, how do you fill in the blanks to finish the truth? And there are different methods. And so everyone has to decide for themselves, what kind of spirituality you have to use to find the meaning of life.
If you find some. I mean, I've seen you two saying, Deepak saying, a world completely ruled by science would be hell on earth. And you responding, the world before science was hellish.
Well, wasn't it? I mean, if you look a couple hundred years ago, people typically died in their 30s. Women who were pregnant, about a third of them died in childbirth. Deepak talks about how science causes pollution, but I think if you look at the skies of London or if people had to, 100, 200 years ago, when people had to burn wood or coal, the most primitive means for warmth, it polluted the earth far more than we have by modern means. And look at the sewage treatment, the water systems were horrible. So science brings us a lot of good, but science can also be used for weapons, which Deepak often points out. And the point is that we need humanity with morality who don't take human knowledge and use it for bad means. But if you want to put it all on the science's back, then the question becomes, do you stop learning about the universe because some people may misuse that truth? That's the real question.
Deepak Chopra, you certainly don't leave God standing or divine consciousness standing on the other side of the Big Bang. Leonard says the universe evolves according to physical law with no grander purpose, and he applauds those with the courage to live with that knowledge. You say the universe has a purpose and human beings are part of that purpose. How do we know that?
I quote Leonard from the book. He says, Einstein was moved to a state of reverence by the rationality made manifest in the universe. So there are 2 points here. If it's a rational universe, Einstein also, by the way, said the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. So there are 2 points to be made here. Can a rational universe have an irrational source? That's the first point. And the second point is, what is reverence? Is it something that I can weigh and measure in units of mass and energy? Is reverence not a spiritual attribute?
Is it so different from awe? I can stand in awe of Fermat's theorem,
yes,
but doesn't mean that I treat it as a manifestation of the divine. One could, but it doesn't require that.
No, but it's not awe, reverence, humility, curiosity, insight, imagination, intuition, free will. These are always associated with spiritual qualities.
Have been, but now we're in the scientific age. Do they still need to be?
Yes, because any understanding by looking at the brain is inferential. You know, I'll ask you and your audience just now to imagine a red rose. Can you see it?
Yes.
Where is the picture? If I go into your brain, I'll see electrochemical activity, but I will not see a picture. That is now known as the hard problem in science. We can see the physical correspondence to subjective experience, but we can never actually explain the physical, the subjective experience.
Leonard,
it
is that God painting that rose in my mind?
You know, don't, when you say the word God, you're...
The divine?
Yes, a divine... eternal consciousness in which we experience the brain. You know, he says that science is based on a loop. Theory, observation, experimentation. Theory is in consciousness. It's conceived in consciousness. Experiment is designed in consciousness. Observation is in consciousness. And science acknowledges that it cannot explain consciousness. So we have to say there's a mystery here.
Well,
no matter what the neuroscience is.
Are you just paddling in the shallow waters of consciousness, a kind of, you know, building little sailboats, but you're really out there in the divine?
Science, first of all, there's two issues. There's the mind-brain duality question, and there's a question of consciousness. There, as you mentioned earlier, there is a lot of evidence today from neuroscience that the mind and there is no separation between the mind and the brain, that we can stimulate thoughts, feelings, perceptions in you by stimulating parts of your brain. The question of consciousness, however, is one that science does not address now. I mean, science beginning to address it. I do not say that science cannot address it, but one of my friends who's a famous neuroscientist who works on consciousness admits that we don't even have a good definition of consciousness. So what we're doing is, because we're scientists and we don't make big leaps or we don't know where we're going, science works in small steps. What we're doing is studying the brain, you know, very minute, specific properties at a time, be it vision, be it memory, different parts of the brain, where they come from, how they're produced. And we're hoping that eventually a picture of what it means to experience these feelings that Deepak was talking about emerges from that. Now, there's no guarantee that it will, but even if science never understands it, even if people aren't capable of understanding it, that doesn't mean that it comes from some undefined or divine presence that people define however they want.
People react to these questions with such kind of extremes. I've got a little tape here from a couple of angles. Here's the co-founder of the Creationist Museum in Petersburg, Kentucky, Ken Ham. Got a lot of press attention when his museum was built in 2007, and since then he continues to lecture children, saying the Bible is the literal Word of God.
The Bible claims to be the Word of God who knows everything, who's always been there, who's told us the whole history of the universe. And mums, dads, and teachers, here's the history that the Bible teaches us, that God created a perfect world. He created everything in 6 days, just a few thousand years ago.
A very literal interpretation. Deepak Chopra's not embracing that. But then, on the other side, you've got Christopher Hitchens, who, with Richard Dawkins and others, very sharp critic of religion and spiritual answers. Here he was in 2008 at the Hauenstein Center making his case again that the hope for a world designer is only a hope. He's saying here in his kind of flash language, it's inherent in our human insecurities. Christopher Hitchens.
It is the wish to be a slave. It is the desire that there be an unalterable, unchallengeable, tyrannical authority who can convict you of thought crime while you are asleep. A celestial North Korea.
There it is. Is it the wish to be a slave, to believe in this consciousness?
I want to make one thing clear, that both of these fellows were talking about the biblical God, and neither of us believes in that. And I would also wish that I wish I could talk to this Ken Ham and ask him about these passages about stoning homosexuals to death and putting disobedient children to death and what he thinks of that. Because if he believes that the Bible is a literal word of God, then he must support those things.
I think science enriches the possibilities of God and the understanding of God. You know, I was reading recently a book by Joel Primack, who's a modern cosmologist, and he says that the Big Bang, occurred everywhere, not in a particular location, because there was no location. That, in my mind, evokes the image of omnipresence. The Big Bang started with a tiny dot and now spans billions of years across, billions of light years. Mm-hmm. What was the energy that took this from here to here? It's omnipotent energy. Okay. And then finally, that the Big Bang contained in potential very precise laws. Mm-hmm. If they'd been off by one in a million, you wouldn't have this conversation right now.
But maybe those laws were also born in that moment with the particular way that it happened.
Okay, but those precise laws that describe everything that's happening in the universe, it's almost, you know, for me, it's a metaphor of omniscience. So I see in the modern cosmological story a much more magnificent, much more awe-inspiring God than the God of traditional religion. The God of traditional religion is a man, usually of an ethnic background, squeezed into the volume of a body and the span of a lifetime. The God we're talking about is the field of possibilities that is expressing the infinite diversity of this universe.
Even with this broad definition, we've still got a debate here. Antonia in Hyde Park, Vermont. Antonia, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say that the argument that I make towards my devout atheist father, and I try to get him all the time, is the latest one was, so you see that car out there. If I were to tell you that no one made that car, you'd think I was crazy. But this whole life that we're living, our whole experience on Earth, the Earth, everything, universe, nobody created that. And I'm not about to say who or what did, but that's my point. And I didn't stump him, or at least I don't think I did.
Antonia, thanks for your call. Leonard, again, does it stump you? Does mystery equal an argument for divinity?
No, not at all. I mean, you answered the question by the way you stated it. But I think that it's important to realize that.
But Antonia says to her father,
beautiful and very ordered, amazing things can happen through randomness, and we see it all the time. A rainbow is beautiful. I don't think there's a good argument that God is standing there painting the rainbow. Look at a snowflake. A snowflake has tremendous regularity and beauty. If you look at one close up, it's very artistic, and everybody I think fundamentalists can agree that comes from water turning into ice. So,
Deepak, a magnificent randomness at work, perhaps?
Randomness is another word for creativity. If it wasn't random, there would be no creativity. If a system is fixed, where's the creativity? I think chance, purpose, randomness, creativity, all are part of the creative process. When an Edison discovers the light bulb, he does 1,000 experiments to finally get it. Okay, why can't we give the same attributes to a larger consciousness than ours? You know, we have not explained our own consciousness. How are we going to explain the divine consciousness? You know, first explain yourself.
Does it put you out of business, Deepak, if Leonard's right?
Does it put me? I'm not, you know, I'm as curious as he is. Okay, I, in fact, do not argue with the facts he has, but I do say, and he acknowledges, there's the unknowable. And for me, the unknowable humbles me into humility and reverence, and that's a religious experience.
But Leonard says, you know, mystery does not equal divinity. I hear you kind of arguing that in a way it does, that this unknowable thing surrounds us and
this
must.
This is the God of Spinoza. It's the God of Emerson, the God of Thoreau, the God of the sages of the Upanishads, the God of Pythagoras, the God of Plato.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about science and spirit with Deepak Chopra and theoretical physicist Leonard Mlodinow. They come from very different places in the cosmic scheme. They met over big questions about quantum physics and more. They're out with a new book called War of the Worldviews, Science versus Spirituality. And they take on the very biggest questions, questions that are still very much in play in our public life today. Let's go right to our listeners. Kevin in Providence, Rhode Island. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. So here's what I would like to talk about, which is I don't understand why we have this kind of dichotomy between spirituality and science. And I come from a social science background, and really what we kind of talk about a lot is just that it's all a story. I mean, it's a narrative that we came up with thousands of years ago because we're, you know, terrified of death, and it has perpetuated for thousands of years. And
yeah, but may I ask you, Kevin,
we're going back and forth between, you know, hard sciences and spirituality when those are both basically socially constructed ideas that have kind of come to be in their own time and era.
So you're not judging at all here. It's all a story, just kind of a story. Science is a story. Spirituality is a story. It's all just a bedtime story?
Science at least has stuff that you can back it up with. So I'm going to hold that a little bit higher than spirituality. But, yeah, and it doesn't mean you have to be freaked out or terrified of anything. You know, I'm sitting here on a beautiful day and it's nice out, but...
Don't you kind of want to know what's behind all that beauty, that nice day, your sense of ease or peace?
Well, yeah, and hard sciences are pretty good at figuring that type of stuff out, you know, weather and all that. But other than that, the godness or that type of spirituality, I think it's just, you know, it's people saying, you know, there is a God and you should be good because there is a God. And if you're not good, then this will happen. And if you are, then this will happen.
Well, that's got utility, clearly. I guess it's the reality that we're looking at here. Let us hold that for a moment, Kevin. I appreciate your call. Let me get one more from Los Angeles. Saad is calling. Saad in California, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is for Deepak Chopra, and it's a little bit of a philosophical question.
Good.
If we assume that the statement, I think, therefore I am, is true, logically speaking, I don't think, therefore I am not, is that also true or not? If I die, if I don't have any neurologic activity,
okay,
that I do not exist anymore.
Stick with us, Saad. Deepak Chopra.
Okay,
I think, therefore, I am. If the opposite is the opposite true?
Opposite is truer because I am. I think. If I wasn't, I wouldn't be able to think.
But I think do I stop existing?
No, you don't, because you have, in fact, the whole universe stops existing if you stop existing. The universe is as I am, because it's a human nervous, it's a human universe conceived in a human consciousness, observed in a human consciousness, measured in a human consciousness.
Saad, are you satisfied?
Here's the statement. I am, therefore the universe is. Figure out who you are and you'll have some access to this. The biggest spiritual quest is the answer to the question, who am I?
Saad, we're going to leave you there with a little straight-up Chopra, but here's a question for you, Deepak. Greg asks, he says, Deepak Chopra uses the word consciousness to mean whatever he wants it to mean. Please ask him for a definition.
Consciousness is a field of potential. It is a realm of correlation. It is a field of uncertainty. It is it is the field of intentionality, and it is our identity. Without knowing consciousness, we will never understand what free will is, how we initiate action, how do we initiate action, and how we experience subjectivity.
Do you think,
by studying the brain, you are inferring consciousness. You're not observing consciousness because consciousness is the observer.
I wonder if cultural background makes a difference here. I think in your cultural background, Deepak, you've got Hinduism, maybe some Sikh influence as well.
I'm also talking about the perennial philosophy of Aldous Huxley and Emerson Thoreau and Plato and Pythagoras.
These cultures mix, they dance, We see all kinds of blends. But let me put this to you. I spent some no small time in India studying Vedas and Upanishads and the rest. Is it possible that Hinduism is sits easier with science than Christianity. Hinduism, in its cosmology, has huge periods of time. Nobody is stuck on 7 days or thousands of years ago. It has vast, vast, almost incomprehensible sweeps of time in its, in its own teaching. Yes. Does that make it easier to sort of?
It does, and Buddhism makes it even easier because Buddhism goes beyond direct cause effect. It doesn't ask the question, who created what? Because in Buddhism, everything is interdependent co-arising. Mm-hmm. Buddhism doesn't even have the dualism of biological organism and the environment. It is more consistent with Thierry Desjardins, that the biological organism is a manifestation of the biosphere, which is also an expression of the geosphere and the theosphere and the noosphere. So, while Buddhism and Hinduism are more expansive in their understanding, I think we can find correlates in Western philosophy as well.
Eric in Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Eric. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. My question is that one of the most annoying things about this whole argument is that it becomes kind of a one-upmanship match with big personalities on both sides. I want to know how much hubris really sullies the whole entire conversation on both sides.
Now, but where do you see hubris? Is it hubris for humans to attempt to understand the cosmos? Is it hubris to assert a consciousness that what overarches science or underlies it? Where do you see the hubris?
I see the hubris where it really defies the concepts of both, where it defies the morality of the spirituality and it defies the objectivity of the science, where it becomes about that person.
I agree with him, actually. As Leonard and I have traveled together, it's less about debate and one-upmanship and winning and more about trying to understand the other perspective. So I actually I have total empathy with what he's saying, because what he's saying is where I seem to be going myself right now.
Leonard, do you deny the morality of the spirituality? Do you take it that far? I mean, there's all kinds of spirituality. You may find some more morality here than there. I don't know. But our callers are saying that would be hubris. But is that your...
I think that morality, of course, is very important. And I think spirituality is very important for people to have in their lives. So I don't deny
As a tool for sustaining social morality, as a tool for personal substance.
Yeah, as a tool, as a spirituality is important to give you strength to.
Or as honesty with honestly facing a divine reality. I guess that's where you draw your line. You've got Einstein's awe, but you're not calling that.
I even as a child, I was an admirer of Einstein's writings on religion. And if you want to call the source of the nature of the laws of physics God, then I believe in that God. But that's far different than the concept most people have. But I hope that the listeners don't feel that I think that human beings aren't or shouldn't be spiritual creatures, or that that's not an important part of people's lives. And everyone has to find their own faith. But science is a separate enterprise.
Deepak?
I find imposed morality immoral. And that's what religion does, traditional religion. It imposes morality.
But there will be many people who say, good heavens, Deepak, without that, where are we?
The spiritual experience gives you morality. Morality is the byproduct of the experience of transcendence, of mystery, of reverence. H.G. Wells once said, self-righteous morality is just jealousy with a halo. And that's what most religious morality is. But morality that springs from awe and mystery and reverence and love and compassion as a true experience is irreversible.
Greg in Jackson, Tennessee. Greg, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is a really great debate, and as a scientist by trade, I've come up with one thing I would like to pose, and that is the inability of scientists to actually prove the existence of love. However, we all, or I would assume that we all, believe that love is real and love exists, the love of a parent for its child. However, we can only prove the characteristics that man labels is love. But we can't really prove the existence of love if that individual actually loves someone. And I just thought I'd throw that out and see if it makes any sense.
Happy to have it, Gary. Leonard, is science blind to love? If it is that proof that science is blind to divinity?
No. And, again, that's a question that can be answered on different levels. Science does not address the meaning of love, the feeling of love. Neuroscientists.
It doesn't?
No.
It couldn't?
It's not the point of science is to make predictions about the future.
Tom, how do you prove that your mother loved you?
Well, but hang on.
Well,
a
you
second.
Can study the brain. You can study the brains. People feeling love and study how their brains are reacting. Right. And
if you'd like to begin to parse it that way, evolution favors those.
Yeah.
I mean, who maybe have that warmth, that support, that must create cascades of hormones and all
there are evolutionary biologists study yes. the possible function the purpose of love, and you can study the hormones of love, the oxytocin or whatever mm-hmm. is emitted in your system when you say that we report that you're feeling love.
Mm-hmm.
So that's on one level. Science addresses the mechanics of love, but then the meaning of love or what it feels like is something that's beyond science. Science is there to find the laws and to predict what's going to happen in the future. So scientists can say if you have too little of this neuropeptide, maybe you won't ever experience love. Or they can say that if you're looking at a picture of a loved one, this other neuropeptide will come out, or this is what happens in your brain.
There's always science. There's always some mystery left in how we interpret that. Patrick in Boston, thanks for calling, Patrick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
A comment and then a question for Deepak Chopra.
Good.
A comment, if God exists, if God is actually out there somewhere, wouldn't God be the ultimate scientist? And then that would be sort of the nexus point between the two. And secondly, for Deepak Chopra, how does he consider the concept of that we were human, we're here now in this time, but would we not be just a flash in a pan, say a million years from now, will we have even left a mark? And then how does that relate to the concept of God or transcendence?
Patrick, okay. I appreciate your call. Deepak Chopra?
Well, yeah, I think of God as not only a mathematician and a physicist and a biologist and evolutionary thinker and all of that. And I also think that his second question is very important.
Are we just a flash in the pan? Is there something without us?
As people, we are a flash in the pan. But we have a larger identity. If you go beyond your physical identity, your ethnic identity, your religious and cultural identity, your global identity, there's a deeper identity which is cosmic, which is the pursuit of all wisdom traditions, to find that part of you which is not this impermanent manifestation of that larger identity, the transcendent identity.
Let's go to William in Charleston, South Carolina. William, you're on.
Oh, thanks. I'm really delighted to ask this question. Many physicists today have concluded that there are multiple universes, indeed infinite number of universes. Some are collapsing, some are expanding. How do you have an infinite number of gods for these exploding and collapsing universi?
Deepak Chopra, do you have to have one for each?
No, if God is infinite possibilities, we know from mathematics that infinity divided by infinity remains infinity.
Mm-hmm.
Infinity added
careful,
to
careful.
Infinity. I'll be careful.
Add and subtract. They're safer.
Okay, but you cannot divide infinity, period. You can quantify.
Is that true?
Well, infinity divided by two is still infinity, yeah. But I
infinity
just
divided by infinity? What's that?
I don't know.
That's a barn dance.
Yeah.
but Deepak is happy to see one great consciousness behind all those universi.
They're not relevant to us. If we can never experience them, forget it, He's talking about a cosmic Las Vegas, basically.
Well, maybe not relevant, but as the moment our human scientists begin to project into that, it takes on a patina of relevance to me. Samantha in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Samantha, thanks for calling.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is the point of consciousness when we believe that point of consciousness actually occurs in a life system. The reason I ask this question is I have a 6-year-old autistic daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have done with her, we're a handful of people that have done only what we have done in the United States. We have traveled outside the country and used her own bone marrow stem cells to help her. We have seen amazing results with my daughter. She's able to sleep through the night where she was once an insomniac. She can read, which before she could barely even talk.
But it makes the stem cell debate and presumably the embryonic stem cell debate very key to you, though you've gone a different way. Our time is so short. Let me just pick that up. Deepak Chopra, this consciousness that is at the center of your conversation, you know it's also at the center of a hot political conversation when it begins. What, if we go to embryonic stem cells, for example, does it bring you a kind of moral view?
Yeah, it does. All stem cells are pluripotential cells.
They can turn into just about anything in the human body.
And therefore, they are closer to consciousness than anything else. So I totally favor all kinds of research that takes you back to potential rather than committed to this autistic manifestation.
So use it rather than who say, no, it's too close to the divine. It's an expression of the divine. It's alive. Don't mess with
it. No, I think it's the future. In fact, it's stem cell research, cloning your own cells for spare parts, giving you spare parts. This is all taking advantage of the infinite consciousness because a pluripotential cell is, in fact, infinite, all the possibilities that make a biological organism.
Leonard, you've seen in this country in recent years how this debate and on science, religion, spirituality, the limits of science has held up science. I mean, it's been, you know, people have thrown themselves across the tracks in front of it in any number of points. There's been a lot of skepticism about science itself in significant quarters in this country. In your debate, sort of taking it around the country with Deepak, do you think we're getting past that? Or are we still
Well, one of the reasons, okay, so in War of the Worldviews talks about our different worldviews in the areas of the physical universe, life, and the mind-brain question. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was to bring the people, to try and give them a better understanding of what science is, how we came to all this knowledge, not just what our current knowledge is, but how we came to it and what is the scientific method. And I think that the more we can educate people about what science really is, the more we can throw some wet blankets on some of the fireworks that are going on.
I don't know where this debate ends. Maybe never. Maybe there is a convergence. But it's great to see two views like yours, Deepak Chopra, and yours, Leonard Mlodinow, brought together working on it side by side. It's terrific. Co-authors of the new book, War of the Worldviews, Science versus Spirituality. Many thanks to each of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you,
Tom. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.